We are live. Welcome back to episode number 11 of Calibrated with Scott. I'm Scott. I'm joined today by my co-host, Just Me. Just Me, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
And KSV, how are you doing?
Tired, early morning.
Yeah, both of us. Same brother, same. And I am joined by a new regular guest host, Brian Beletic. How are you doing today, Brian?
I'm doing well, and I'm glad to be back on Calibrated.
Yeah, we're glad to have you back. You're my personal favorite guest, so this is going to be a good episode, again, as always. We have a lot to talk about today. We have progress around the whole front. We have the Seversk pocket tightening for the Ukrainians. We also have a possible operational encirclement of Bakhmut or Artemovsk coming up soon. It will change names when ownership changes. Even more threatening to the situation in Bakhmut, we have a Russian push towards Krasnoy or Ivanitsky to the rear, which has actually severed the main highway connecting the city to its supply hub of Chasiv Yar and further back to Konstantinivka. So the situation at the hottest part of the front, which is Bakhmut, has become dire for the Ukrainians. Brian, obviously the right idea would be at this time is to withdraw. We're seeing huge casualties taken by the Ukrainians each and every day. At what point is the PR not worth the losses that they're sustaining?
That is a really good question. And I think it depends on several different factors. We remember Ukrainian President Zelensky went to Bakhmut, or at least he pretended to take the risk of going to Bakhmut, a frontline city. He said that no other Ukrainian city would fall to the Russians after Lysychansk and Severodonetsk. And so here we are. And what does he do? Is he going to give the order and leave and allow Russian forces to enter and take Bakhmut and be the one who allowed that to happen, to allow another city, after saying it wouldn't happen, to allow a city to fall into Russia's hands? Or is he going to fight to the very last? Well, you know, it's an easy decision for him because he's not the one doing it, to fight to the last man standing. So is it going to be another Lysychansk where they, at the very end, they scattered and left? Or is it going to be a Mariupol where they're encircled and they stubbornly fight until almost the last man?
Yeah, and
hard to tell.
Yeah, and just for our listeners' sake, if you guys don't know, the Bakhmut sits on a very strong defense line for the Ukrainians. It involved Soledar, which its collapse has opened up the door to further collapse in the area. Soledar was a fortress that was not supposed to fall as quickly as it did. With the fall of Soledar, now Seversk becomes extremely threatened. Its supply is very precarious, and with Russian initiative on the whole front, it looks like that city will also be captured in quick order. So with the fall of Bakhmut, it opens up to a huge PR hit. And this is something that I think our listeners need to understand, is that the sacrifice that the Ukrainians are making now may seem in vain, but the next defense line is not as strong. The Ukrainians are going to be routed at this point, most likely. It looks very difficult for them to pull out of Bakhmut now with the current surrounding situation and do it in a orderly order, you know, and get out properly. So the defense line is very important for the Ukrainians, and with its collapse, probably the collapse of the Donbass, most likely. Moving down to Uglodar, I had a another question for you, Brian. We saw a shorter offensive on the fortress town of Ugludar in the south Donetsk front. I wanted to know your thoughts on the I never personally think about it, but it is so important because, you know, we're sitting in our home analyzing and you never think about weather. And apparently the weather has been so bad around Ugludar that air operations have stopped and they've been forced to step back and wait for the weather to better itself. Could this be also a factor in, I mean, obviously it is, but could you expand upon how weather affects offensives just in general? Because it seems like a modern army shouldn't stop because of something so trivial as, you know, rain or overcast.
But sometimes it can. It depends on what assets they have committed. A lot of the drones that are being used are great as long as you have visibility. If there's no visibility, then you cannot really use them. There are systems, thermal imaging that you can use, but these are somewhat more sophisticated. Not every weapon system is going to have them included. I know the most modern battle tanks that Russia has on the battlefield and modernized T-72s and obviously T-90s and T-80s have thermal imaging, but that wouldn't be a capability that everyone has. And as I've tried to impress upon people, this is about combined arms operations. You cannot just have one weapon system operating. So the weather can create an operational pause. We also have to keep in mind that maybe what Russia is doing along the line of contact in Zaporozhye and the southern Donbas, it may just be shaping operations. They could just be keeping pressure on Ukrainian forces along the entire line of contact to deny them the ability to shift forces to, say, Bakhmut or somewhere else. So we have to keep all of these factors in mind. The weather is, like you said, it's very hard for us to remember to take a look at the weather because we're looking at the weather outside of our window most of the time, not what the weather is like in Ugludar.
So, Brian, I think the weather down there has been pretty foggy. I've seen some videos of that. Can you go into a little detail on how that complicates calling in air support and how that affects, you know, just the planes being able to target? Does the fog kind of mess with laser guidance and stuff like that?
I would say the main thing is visibility. I mean, if you cannot see, soldiers aren't going to be shooting. They certainly do not have thermal imaging, aircraft and their weapons. So who's going to call it in? Who's going to be doing laser designation if they can't even see what they're pointing the laser at? So this would create a huge problem for that. I don't know what the state is of Russian military aviation. I would imagine they do have all weather systems that can operate in fog and in the rain, but it might not be something advisable. It might push the risk over a certain threshold where they just figure it's better to just let it clear up. Keeping track of weather is one of these things that people don't really think about when talking about warfare, but it's extremely important. A lot of major military operations have been delayed by the weather throughout history.
So it could be one of those things where the pilots and the aircraft are capable of hitting things on the ground. It's just they have no way for the guys on the ground to see what they need to hit.
Yeah. If it's excessively foggy, it would be very hard for infantry and spotters and forward observers to see a lot of targets. Because if it's, I mean, just think of your own personal experience with fog when it is foggy and what you can see versus the distance where you cannot see. Do you want to really get that close to an enemy position? Yeah, I think the answer would usually be no. You want to keep as much distance between yourself and the enemy. And when it's foggy, that kind of prevents you from doing that.
Just to pivot away from weather, because as interesting as weather is, I feel like we've covered it pretty decently. I wanted to move into something that's happened in the last 2 weeks since you were on last. We've had what I would call a purge. I think when you were on, we had the Interior Ministry get killed in a helicopter crash. I think that had just happened, but we had not seen Alexei Arestovych attempt to resign, and then his resignation was denied, and then he was sacked. And then we also had multiple governors of different oblasties resign as well. In this purge, at least the way I see it, it's a purge. Do you think that this is preparation to tighten down the hatches in the event of a new Russian offensive? Do you think this is just tightening down the hatches because the situation is becoming more dire and they need people that they can trust? Or do you think that this is just really what they say it is, and it's a what are they calling it, JM? It's a
anti-corruption campaign.
Anti-corruption, yeah.
In the middle of a war.
In the middle of the war, so. Yeah. Probably the single worst look you can have.
Well, that's a good question. To be honest, I'm not familiar with a lot of the people who were purged, and I do think that it is a purge. But if you have, so you would have to dig into their political background, their connections, and their personal capabilities, their circles, and what they have influence over, and see what might they be preparing for. So they may be preparing for at least one of two things. One could be, and this is something that the Durand talked about. I'm deferring to their analysis of this. So they have talked about isolating Zelensky and getting more control over the United States, obviously, getting more control over Ukraine for whatever outcome it is that they want to pursue. They need to purge people that were going to get in the way of that. That could be to double down. And there were people who were beginning to have doubts and were looking for ways out, possibly. Or it could be the exact opposite. Maybe we're hearing talk about the U.S. wanting this to be over by summer, which I don't believe, to be honest. But let's just say that that is true. Then they would want to purge people who would get in the way of that, who would want to carry on and could create a rift in Kiev and in the military. So these are the possibilities we have to keep in mind. And the only way we're going to know for sure is just watching events unfold and seeing, you know, which way things go. I think it'll be very obvious that the U.S. will make its intentions very clear soon enough.
And it sounds like they've even made their intentions clearer by the delivery of even longer ranged guided MLRS systems. We have a $2.2 billion aid package that was just announced that included such weapons. Obviously, it's going to probably take a couple months to fulfill this order and bring it in. I don't know who is operating the HIMARS systems currently. I have my suspicions about who's operating them. So they are probably already trained on said munition. So I don't think it's going to take a lot of time to come in. This has to be a clear red line for Russia. What do you see that the Russians moving ahead or with a plan, like a more drastic plan, a more drastic choice of action? Or do you see them weathering it out like they've weathered out everything else and attempting to not escalate and just adapting and overcoming and then, you know, progressing? Where do you see the Russian reaction to this announcement?
It's a good question. I think we have to look at the delivery of these longer range rockets, these ground launched small diameter bombs. Now, this was something that until recently had been under development, and they have made some of them, but not a lot. There's not a large number of these floating around. There's a large number of the rockets, and there's a large number of the guided bombs, but these need to be integrated together. It's not like Legos where you just connect them together. There is a process, and there's only so many that they can do per month. And this is something that all the way back in November, they were talking about. Yes, they could have it ready by 2023, but it'll be in very small amounts. So whatever they're going to have that they transfer over to Ukraine, this will be available in small amounts. I would hope that the Russian military had multiple contingencies in place for the arrival of ATACMS, which is a 300-kilometer range missile fired by the HIMARS system. These ground-launched small-diameter bombs have a purported range of 150 kilometers. That's a little bit further than Russia's Tornado S at 120 kilometers, but falls far short of the Iskander's 400 to 500 kilometers. So again, they're going to be on the battlefield potentially. We're not exactly sure when, because I also read, and again, this is just what the Western media themselves are saying, there's some sort of compatibility issue between these longer range rockets and the HIMARS launchers that Ukraine is currently using. So there is some upgrade, either hardware or software, that needs to be done, or maybe both, and it hasn't been done yet. So when are they going to do that? How are they going to do that? So it's a lot more complicated than just sending them these longer range rockets. And then ultimately, when they start using them, Russia most certainly will adapt. Ukraine has admitted that Russia has adapted to the HIMARS. Between Russia destroying the HIMARS launchers, striking at warehouses where these rockets have been stockpiled, the U.S. running low on these guided rockets, the combination of that has whittled down the volume of HIMARS rockets that can be launched. Also, Russia has adjusted their supply lines, the distribution of stockpiles, and they will do the same with this. And I'm sure that even with the ATACMS, they will adjust to that. Now, they probably will retaliate, but I don't think that there is this, it's something that they have to do. Just like with the strike on the Crimean Bridge. But I don't think it's something that is really, it's not urgent. They have to carry on with what they're doing. They have to stay focused on that and not let these provocations distract them. It's not going to affect them overall operationally. It will cause more damage and more death for sure, but it's not going to change the outcome of the conflict. And that is what Russia needs to focus on.
KSB, did you have a question?
Yes. So one of the things about the glide bombs that was really being hyped up, at least when the media runs over their basic fact chart of it, is that it can come in and hit anything from any direction. And they're making it sound like these things are really hard to intercept. Are they significantly any harder to intercept than, say, a suicide drone?
That's a good question. And I think they would be somewhat limited in their maneuverability. And it would maybe be harder than hitting, say, just a projectile on a very basic ballistic path. But I don't think it's something that's beyond the Russian air defense's capability. Now, the thing is, Russian air defense isn't going to be everywhere all the time. And launchers that are optimized to hit targets like this may not be everywhere they need to be when these come in. And what is going to be a relative nuisance, because they have a small number of these launchers and they pop up randomly here and there to do their damage. So you have to be prepared for them everywhere, or you just have to accept that you're going to suffer a certain amount of loss to these gliding bombs. So, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. There's really no way to know until we see the HIMARS. I mean, we see Russia intercepting them. They've adapted in many ways, actually, not just how they've distributed their forces, their supply lines, and their stockpiles, but also the way they've adjusted their air defense to deal with them. So I think they will most certainly do the same with this.
Well, as you know, Brian, as some Ukrainian commenters have pointed out, if Ukraine can just reach Berdyansk, they could hit the Crimean Bridge. It's a simple thing.
Yeah, that is a simple thing just to, yeah, just to do that. But again, this obsession with hitting the Crimean Bridge or cutting the land bridge, this obsession over this, I mean, I could be completely wrong, but I seem to remember Crimea having several ports and several airports, including an international airport that moves millions of passengers every year. So I, you know, it will impact for sure logistics to and from Crimea, but I don't think it's going to cut it off in the way they imagine.
Yeah, I can't possibly imagine, especially after everything that has come Russia's way, whether it be, you know, economic or military, geopolitical, they've adapted and they've overcome. It's been one of the big stories of the SMO, I think, is just how adaptable the Russian army has been and how they continue to be. When talking about new weapons, we also have a clarification on the tanks, which we didn't have last time. It looks like we have a handful of new Leopard 2A6s coming in, which I'm going to set up a question here, Brian, because I'm having a hard time understanding how this is going to work. You have 30 Abrams coming maybe in a year. Who knows if they'll ever even show up? It kind of seems like an Afghan National Army sort of situation where they're going to have 30 tanks to send to, you know, wherever's next. They have new Leopards coming in, which is a whole nother logistics line on top of the Abrams logistics line. You have older Leopards, which is a whole nother logistics line. You have old Soviet tanks still being delivered from a few states that previously had post-Soviet equipment. And you have Challengers, and they're also talking about sending French Lestrecs. So can you break down how logistics is going to work for these, you know, at most 100 of each of these tanks, and how viable are that is that setup and that many logistic lines?
If they just settled on one main battle tank, Western main battle tank, and sent it to Ukraine, that would be complicated enough. It would be too complicated for it to be effective anytime soon. People have to remember that getting a new weapon system is not like in the movies. It's not an episode of G.I. Joe where, you know, Duke's plane gets shot out from under him, he lands and he jumps into a tank and he keeps fighting Cobra Commander. It's not like that at all. It takes years for a country to integrate a new weapon system into their military. It took Ukraine years to integrate the Bayraktar TB2 drone into their military forces. It wasn't as if they weren't rushing. They wanted to use it in the Donbas region, and they did eventually use it in the Donbas region. It just didn't make any difference. But it still took them time to do that. A tank, you're training these crews. It's a four-man crew versus a three-man crew for a Soviet era and modern Russian tanks. And this is something that usually takes about a half a year. And I've gone into this before in the past. It's not just about learning how to operate your tank on its own. That takes long enough, but then you have to fight as a unit, a tank platoon, a tank company, then you have to learn how to operate in a brigade. All of this takes time to do. Even well-trained American tankers still spent about a year ahead of Desert Storm before going in. We remember that buildup. They were training the whole time before going in there to fight that specific battle, to do that specific mission. But now you have this vast variety of tanks go, and people say, well, Leopard 2s, Leopard 1s, Leopard 2s. There's multiple variants of Leopard 2s, and so you have to learn each one. They have the Leopard 1 and the French AMX 10RC. These are light tanks, and I wouldn't even really call them tanks. They're assault guns. They're too lightly armored to be considered a tank. They could not serve in that role. So what they would do is go with infantry in places where they're not expecting heavy weapons to be used. I don't know where they're going to go and find that environment. I don't think they're going to find that environment. So they're not being sent what they need. They're being sent whatever the U.S. and its allies have. And the logistics of all of this, again, if it was just one type of tank, that would be bad enough, adding it to everything else Ukraine has to sort out in terms of logistics. But you have all of these different tanks now, different versions of the Leopard 2. The Challenger does not even have the same type of gun as other NATO tanks. It has a rifled gun versus a smooth bore. That is entirely different ammunition that you have to use. And these are all entirely different systems that you have to learn. You cannot just hop out of a Challenger into a Leopard. It doesn't work that way. So they have created a tangled web, a rat's nest of systems that they're sending. And even under the most optimal conditions, these tanks have already been used in recent conflicts, and they've already proven they're no more effective than, say, the T-72s, and whatever else Ukraine had been using. They had over around 1,000 tanks at the beginning of this. They're all gone. And these are not going to be any more effective. And then there's the added problem of them not being familiar with these weapon systems. And remember, every single thing that breaks has to go 1,000 kilometers to the Polish border to get fixed, and then another 1,000 kilometers back to rejoin the battle. And tanks do not travel that type of distance on their own. They have to be either on a truck or they have to be on a train. And Russia has complicated that matter significantly.
Oh, come on. You're not going to drive an Abrams across Ukraine?
No, you're not going to do that. There will be nothing left of the engine by the time you got to the front line. Or the second or third engine.
I guess me to do a question.
I think one of the things that people tend to forget is how heavy like an Abrams tank is, and even a Leopard 1, a Leopard 2. People forget when Trump wanted to have his parade, one of the reasons the army said he couldn't have it was because the tanks are so heavy, they'll destroy the road. And I mean, Ukraine doesn't have the best road network in the world as it is. So,
I mean, they're going to have a lot. Go ahead. Sorry.
You need to move, you know, other things along that road. You got to move trucks, supply trucks, and everything else on that road. You can't just destroy the road by sending three Abrams battalions down the road. And then, you know, how does the rest of your logistics catch up? They're going off-roading.
I hope that they donate 31 semi trucks and trailers for those Abrams while they're at it, because that those trucks moving those tanks around are going to get a lot more action than the tanks themselves. I wanted to again segue into another new segment that I want to do, and it's basically our new guest host Brian is going to be semi-regular on the channel now, so he should be on at least once a month is the goal. And it's been 2 weeks since the last time we're on, so I'm going to go ahead and call it our 2 week take. And if you have one, anybody who's on guest hosting or hosting the podcast is more than welcome to hop in. And I just had a 2 week take that I wanted to bring up, and it's just something that I've noticed over the last 2 weeks that is very important to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. And that is that the initiative has fully switched. My 2 week take is that the Russians now have the full initiative in Ukraine. 2 weeks ago, you could have talked about the Kremenia offensive still progressing for the Ukrainians, possibly. There was talks about a Zaporozhye offensive. We were hearing whispers of like 40,000 troops stationed in Zaporozhye, which may still be going on. But as far as I can see, outside of Ukrainians properly defending and beating the Russians like they did around Ugledar with the weather worsening and so on, the Russians are the ones making the moves across the entire board. And it's not just the strategic or a more analytical aspects of it, where somebody who's paying attention's like, oh, we can see all of this progressing, and we know that the Russians now have the initiative. It is now into mainstream thought and the zeitgeist, even in Kiev, that the Russians now have the initiative, and that they are the ones that are deciding when and where things are happening. Kiev is scrambling for mobilization. They're talking about if we are going to leave Bakhmut or not, and even just talking about, oh, well, maybe we're going to leave, or no, we're going to stay and fight to the last, is an admission that you are on the back foot now. And I think this is very important, because we've kind of come full circle in a year from where the Russians started, they had the initiative, the Ukrainians surrendered land for time. They regrouped, they organized, they came back, they were supplied with a whole new army from the West. They went on a couple offensives. The Russians blunted those offensives for the most part. Liman is kind of up for debate. And they took back a good portion of territory, whether we want to admit it or not. It was the withdrawals from these areas were pretty well controlled and organized. Kharkov was a little bit more sloppy. Kherson was handled very well. But the Ukrainians did take back this land. No matter what they got out of the land, they achieved their goals in these areas, maybe not to the extent that they wanted to, but they did. And now we're seeing that this has completely stopped. There is not a single area of the front where the Ukrainians have the initiative. They are not on the front foot, and they are fully defensive. And this benefits the Russians, because the Ukrainians have a completely ruined electrical infrastructure. So their logistics is already squeezed as is. And now you're forcing them to rotate to Zaporozhye, to the LPR, down to Donetsk. You know, are they going to stick around Bakhmut, where you're pushing the hardest, or are they going to go defend Ugledar? And then if they go and defend Ugledar, does Seversk open up? Does the forest north of Seversk open up to be captured? So that is my 2-week take, is that the Russians now have the full initiative in Ukraine. Will they maintain it? I don't see how they lose it at this point, but it's always possible. And did you want to go?
Yeah, I think that your analysis is mostly correct. And it's worth pointing out that what we've seen since the beginning of the month of January is a slow building up of pressure. So obviously, the month started as the other months had been, where it was just Russia only attacking around Artyomovsk / Bakhmut. And then after 20 January, they started attacking in Zaporizhia. Now that turned more into a fixing operation. And then they started in Ugledar. And then the Ukrainians had to divert reserves to Ugledar to prevent it from falling. They've frustrated the Russians there and pushed them out of Ugledar. They did have some footholds there, but the Russians still have made ground around there and look set to continue their attack there. And interestingly, the Ukrainians even had to draw some units away from up north, which meant that the Russians have been able to advance up north. And now it seems that they're advancing, albeit slowly, all across the northern front. So yeah, all the various talk so far of Ukrainian offensives is gone. And Zelensky is saying that the West needs to give us every last weapon that they have, even if it's combat duty stocks or it's World War III. Note of caution, of course, which is that in order to properly turn this to their advantage instead of opening up a grind, the Russians need to open up one or two other major axes of attack that so far are not open. And above all, whatever they do, they need to take territory, because taking territory will rob Kiev of not just negotiating leverage. It will not just protect deep Russian infrastructure better from potential retaliation and attack, but it will also drain the Ukrainians of manpower by draining population away from them. And you do that, and the Ukrainian state will get put into a death spiral. So for the moment, the Russians have the initiative, but I think they need to do more and quite a bit more to actually capitalize on it.
I couldn't agree more. I think that that is also their plan. I'm sure that they have something in the works so that they don't lose this advantageous position that they've put themselves in. KSB.
I think my take is that we are now watching the beginning of the end for the Ukrainian military. They are rushing like a firefighter brigade, trying to put out one fire and then another, and increasingly they are unable to do so, at least not before they lose key positions. Big Surge on Twitter actually pointed this out, how the Russians are now attacking in one area, forcing Ukraine to move all of their reserves over there. Then they'll attack in the area where those reserves were, forcing the Ukrainians to move those reserves back. And to me, it looks like that Ukraine is now in the position that Russia was in during the summer, which is a front line that is very long and not enough manpower, at least not enough adequate manpower to fully man it, which means they constantly have to keep rotating these reserves to one area or next, which isn't good for the morale of soldiers or, you know, just for their stamina. And the difference is that when Russia had that problem in the summer with Kharkov, they were able to mitigate that because, well, they have a population of 140 plus million. They have a standing pool of reservists of over 2 million. So they were just able to call up 300,000 reservists and train them and send them into combat. Ukraine doesn't really have that option. Now, yes, I know they love to go out and just, you know, drag teenagers kicking and screaming out of a high school classroom and throw them into the front lines with a rifle and say, you're a soldier now. But I think, like Brian can tell you, there's a huge difference between a trained soldier and just someone who's been given an AK, given 5 days of training, and then being shoved out onto the front line. There's a big difference in effectiveness. And in some cases, I'm going to assume that the guy who's had only 5 days of training is probably more of a hindrance than a help in a lot of situations under fire. And so I don't see any way, short of a few NATO battle groups entering the fighting, I see no way for Ukraine to reverse this situation the same way that Russia did. I don't think they can. And even if they are able to come up with a, just assume that this 40,000 man force that they talk about in Zaporozhye actually exists. Remember, we had the 1 million man one that was supposedly being formed in Kherson. Assuming the 40,000 one in Zaporozhye does exist, okay, what's to stop Russia from just calling up another 100, 200,000 reservists? There is nothing. There's nothing Ukraine can do that will change the situation. And it goes back to what I've always said, both here and on Twitter, which is Russian victory in this war is inevitable because the mathematics of war weigh so heavily in Russia's favor. There's no way for Ukraine to top that. There's no way really for the West to top that unless they want to actually get involved in a direct shooting war. And I think Ukraine has hit its high point. To compare it to the Civil War, Ukraine has already had, you know, the Kharkov offensive would have been their Chancellorsville. Now it's all going to be downhill from here. It could be slow. It may take another year, but we will never see another situation like this summer where Russia is on the back foot against the Ukrainian military because the Ukrainian military just doesn't have it in them anymore.
Yeah, if I could jump in, I agree with that. I just want to point out that Russia is very clearly fighting a war of attrition. People, especially in the West, they tried to hold this against Russia. Oh, look how slowly they're making progress. So they're making slow progress. It's true, but they're also going through their men and equipment much more slowly than the Ukrainians, significantly so. When we talk about these offensives, if you're in a war of attrition, whether you want to admit it or not, or you want to fight like you're in it or not, if you go on the offensive like Ukraine did around Kharkov and also Kherson, they lost brigades worth of men and machines doing that. So they got this territory, but they traded what was left of their army. Their reserves were all traded in to make those gains. And I, at the time, I compared it to the battle, the Ardennes offensive, where the Germans took their last reserves and they threw it into one last big offensive, and they exhausted those reserves and they had nothing left. And this is what they did. They, just as you said, the fire brigade, they're going from one place to the other, trying to put out the fires. And in the process, they're going to be exhausted. So we have to keep that in mind. This is the slow grind. It could be frustrating for people watching, but they are slowly dismantling the Ukrainian military. And there is really no way for them to build these capabilities back up. What I thought was interesting, maybe my take over the last 2 weeks, are these weapon deliveries. How you see the West in almost a tangible panic, and they pledged all of these weapons, and we remember the euphoria around the pro-NATO camp, and then very quickly it faded as people, even in the Western media, started explaining, you can't just send tanks. You can't just send these tanks to Ukraine and have them use it. There's extensive training. The aircraft, the UK came out and said, you have to train for like 5 years to learn how to fly an F-16. This is not feasible. This isn't really an option. And so the growing awareness in the West and in the Western public, who have so far fallen for all of the war propaganda, this collective awakening to the reality of what is actually happening versus what they thought was happening, I think that is a major development over the last 2 weeks. I'm looking at the list of the last assistance package right now, and I noticed that it's broken up into two lists. And the first list is what they are drawing down from existing stocks, and it is much shorter than the list of contracts that they are going to begin arranging with arms manufacturers for equipment Ukraine needs. And things on this list include counter-battery radar, which we talked about previously, how important that is in a conflict where artillery is being so heavily used. And we talked about how when you look at the Ministry of Defense reports from Russia, how they are talking about hitting these counter-battery radars almost every day. They're gone. They have to replace them, and they don't have them sitting around to just send Ukraine. They have to build them. They have to get contractors to build them. So we can see the war of attrition slowly unfolding in Russia's favor, and we can see the military-industrial capacity of the West simply was not prepared for this, and it is not something that you can simply make up for by just expanding production. It is a process that takes months, if not years, to do.
Yeah, I think that we have finally arrived. A lot of people have been talking about it for a long time, the war of attrition. And I think we finally arrived at the moment where you're really starting to see the war of attrition like take effect. The Ukrainians are, if you look at the MOD report, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, they were talking about, you know, two tanks here, three tanks down here, six armored vehicles, 100 Ukrainian soldiers, you know, KIA, whatever. If you believe, whether you believe those numbers or not, the fact is that there are consistencies in the MOD report and patterns that you can look at to see some level of truthfulness. And whether you believe the Russian MOD or not, their numbers have dropped. If they're not being honest, they are being very bad propagandists and liars, because now you're seeing maybe on a MOD report, one tank or two tanks across the whole line. You're seeing a lot more pickup trucks. The emphasis on counter-battery warfare and the number of destroyed howitzers and self-propelled guns has even dropped. It's still high, but 3-4 weeks ago, they were talking, you know, 6-7 systems along the whole front line every day, which is just completely untenable for the Ukrainians to sustain. There's no possible way that even the West is going to sustain that high of losses. And I think that you're just seeing the gaps being filled with whatever they possibly can. And the attrition aspect is definitely the leading cause of Ukrainian issues. And it's not just attrition in weapons. It's also attrition in morale. It's attrition on logistics. It's attrition on the economy of Ukraine. So I couldn't agree more with that, Brian. KSB, do you have a question?
I just wanted to make two very quick little comments here. First of all, we should all remember that according to Russian media, Ukrainian media, even Western media, we have not seen even the bulk of Russia's called up reservists enter the fight yet. They are all in the combat area, but none of them have been, most of them have not been activated, not been put in the front line. So Ukrainian defenses are crumbling, and they haven't even been faced with the bulk of the forces that Russia has called up yet. Another thing that people should remember are the words that were spoken by President Putin, I believe 2 days ago now, where he said that Russia is very well aware of escalations by Ukraine, and that Russia has planned responses to all of these things. And those responses are not limited to armored vehicles. And that doesn't necessarily mean nuclear or chemical weapons, but there are conventional weapons in Russia's arsenal that Putin has, as of yet, not allowed the Russian military to use. And if Ukraine gets a TACAMS and they decide to shoot them into Russia, I have a feeling we will start to see some of those more powerful conventional weapons start to get thrown in. And so, you know, it doesn't look good at all from any way you look at it for Ukraine.
Yeah, it's definitely a precarious situation, to say the least. And they're not even hiding it. The officials are all talking about it. I mean, Aristovich has gone completely Russian somehow. One guy I never expected to become a turncoat is now basically telling everybody the truth. It's going to be an interesting 2 weeks. I think that this next 2 weeks is going to see a paradigm shift, at least for the public on Ukraine. I think that you're going to see, it's definitely difficult decision time for the AFU and Zelensky and the Kiev regime, but just if they don't make the difficult decision, I always say that they have the choice between a bad decision and a worse decision. And right now they are continuing to actively choose the worst decision, in my personal opinion. They've chose the worst decision the entire time. They could have negotiated in March. They could have negotiated before the war. But we're seeing them do very German-esque things, very Stalingrad-ish things, where they are forcing all of these brigades into a very, very tight, increasingly encircled area, and they're just losing men that they don't have. They can't replace. They need those men, and they're holding a city that once it collapses, it's going to be very bad news for the entire defense of the Donbass for the AFU. I think that is a solid point to wrap it up. We're going to keep it a little shorter and a little sweeter today. JM, did you have a quote to take us out?
Yes, I think often when we think about Russia in particular, when you read Western media, they overfocus too much on President Putin. Indeed, there was once an article from a few years ago that said that politics in Russia only occurs inside the mind of one man, Vladimir Putin. That's wrong. Russia is a nation of now 153 million people, and it has a political class. And often there are stereotypes about what that political class looks like and how it functions, that everything flows from the top down, that there's nothing bottom out. But actually, one of the main levers of political stability and the system in Russia is actually Putin's United Russia Party. And that's what I'm going to close out on in reading a quote from or a John Reuter on the origins of dominant parties about the bottom-up nature of United Russia itself. United Russia's primary party cells average 33 members per cell. Each primary cell is headed by a secretary who is not a full-time employee. Rather, these are the party's activists. They are overwhelmingly public sector employees. Many are neighborhood opinion leaders, school principals, hospital directors, or factory production line supervisors. A majority are female.
Well, that wraps it up for us here at Calibrated. JM, thank you for joining me. KSB, thank you for joining me. And Brian Beledic, thank you so much for being here. I can't wait to have you back in the future. And thank you, everybody. I'll see you next time.